Annecy is a small city in the Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes region in southeastern France, quite close to the borders of both Switzerland and Italy, about 22 miles south of Geneva. Sometimes known as the Pearl of the French Alps, the city lies on the northern tip of Lake Annecy and is surrounded by the gorgeous mountains of the French Alps, an idyllic location that unsurprisingly has become a rather popular tourist destination for both the French and foreigners alike. Even if it weren't for the gorgeous natural surroundings, the city itself is quite beautiful. The Via Vieville, or Old Town section of the city, dates back to Roman times, and the canals that wind through this area of the city have earned another nickname, the Venice of France. Surrounded by vibrant nature and centuries of history, Annecy isn't the type of place you would associate with violent crime. Unfortunately, however, since 2012, Annecy and the surrounding area has been associated with one of the very few random gun attacks in modern French history. This attack resulted in the deaths of three British tourists, 50-year-old Saad Al-Hilli, his wife Iqbal, age 47 at the time, and her mother, Suhaila Al-Alaf, age 74, as well as French cyclist Sylvain Mollier, age 45. Saad and Iqbal's two young daughters thankfully survived the attack. In the near 10 years since this attack took place, many leads have been followed and many theories have been proposed as to who did this and why. However, to this day, no one has been found guilty of the crime, and investigators still have no working theory to explain the motivations behind these killings. While it is of course possible that this was the work of a lone psychopath who truly had no motivations beyond simply killing for the fun of it, the lack of suspects combined with the fact that Saad Al-Hilli's job back in the UK apparently involved sensitive topics have led to a number of speculations, rumors, and actual theories alike swirling around this tragic story. This is the story of the Annecy shootings. The attack took place at a rest area on the side of a mountain road known as the Route Forestière Domaniale de la Coume d'Hyères at approximately 3:45 p.m. on September 5th of 2012. While this case is most commonly known as the Annecy shootings, they technically took place in the tiny town of Chevelines, located on the southern tip of Lake Annecy. Local authorities described the place that the shooting took place in as a picnic spot, a place where people often went for walks. As this was a relatively open and public space, it's no surprise that the scene of the crime was discovered shortly thereafter. Brett Martin, an ex-Royal Air Force pilot who was residing in France at the time, came across the ghastly scene while out riding his bike. Although he arrived shortly after the shooting took place, he had not heard the gunshots, likely because he was still across the river from the location of the shooting when it took place. Water, as it turns out, can mask the sound of gunshots quite well. When Brett came across the scene, the Hillies' 7-year-old daughter, Zainab, who had been shot and critically injured but not killed, was stumbling in the middle of the road and collapsed in front of her family's car. It was later found that she had been shot in the shoulder, beaten, and had suffered head fractures. Thankfully, she was able to recover from her wounds. The victims, Saad Al-Hilli, Iqbal Al-Hilli, Suhaila Al-Alaf, and the French cyclist Sylvain Mollier, were all shot in the middle of the head, a fact which immediately led to fears that this may have been a contract killing. Initially, Zainab was seemingly the only survivor. However, 8 hours after the shooting took place, Saad and Iqbal's youngest daughter, age 4, was found hiding underneath the bodies of her dead relatives. The only thing this poor young girl was able to publicly say about her recollection of events was there was noise, and she was scared. An investigation of the crime scene turned up very little helpful information. The family's BMW had been sharply reversed onto the side of the road prior to the attack, to the point where visible marks were left on the road. When it was found, the car was still running and the doors were locked, indicating that the family was ambushed suddenly and did not have time to react until it was too late. The shooter had specifically targeted the windows of the car, leaving the bodywork virtually unscathed. Investigators were able to positively identify the weapon used in the attack, as the attacker had used the gun to club Zainab across the head, and a piece of it had broken off. Ballistic analysis would reveal that the gun used in the attack was a Luger P06 semi-automatic pistol, a gun which you may recognize if you've ever seen a film set during one of the World Wars. Although the Luger P06 was sold commercially in the US and was adopted by various militaries in Europe during the 20th century, nowadays it's mainly considered to be a collector's item. While not considered to be a very powerful gun, it is reliable and accurate up to 50 yards. In the immediate aftermath of the shooting, investigators were left baffled. There was no sign of theft, and no other immediately obvious motive. The route where the shooting took place was not known as a sketchy area, nor was there a problem with gun violence at all in the region. Evidence at the scene of the crime simultaneously seemed to point to this being done by a professional, and the exact opposite. The methodical execution-style murders, the precision of the shooting, and the hardened resolve needed to even attempt to kill a child in cold blood all point to this being the work of a professional. But at the same time, the killer had left 21 shell casings on the ground, and used an antique collector's item as their weapon of choice, neither of which seemed like things a professional or an experienced killer would do. Shortly following the incident, public prosecutor Eric Maillot said in a press conference, "I won't say it was professional. What I will say is it was tremendous savagery, and what is certain is that somebody wanted to kill." The theories based around this case can essentially be divided into two camps: the lone psychopath theory and the targeted assassination or contract killing theory. Generally, the theories revolving around this being a targeted assassination paint Saad al-Hilli as the main target, with his family being mere collateral damage, and the French bicyclist Sylvain Mollier being an unfortunate bystander who was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. In fact, this was the main line of thinking for quite a while. After all, looking at the puzzle pieces and adding in a splash of bias and common assumptions, a targeted attack against Saad al-Hilli would likely be the first thing to come to mind for many. What we have here is four people dead, an extremely unusual crime to say the least, for ANSI. One of the victims is a French national, the other three are foreigners, one of whom was an Iraqi engineer who supposedly had access to sensitive information, and they had all been shot twice in the head execution style. The conclusion seemed obvious. Saad had gotten got, the others, especially the unrelated Sylvain Mollier, were simply unlucky enough to be there when Saad's past caught up with him. So, working under the assumption that this was a targeted attack, and that Saad al-Hilli was the main target, we can look to his background to see what the potential motivation for these murders might have been. Saad al-Hilli, along with his wife Iqbal, were both Iraqi-born British nationals who had been living in the UK for over 20 years. According to a family friend named James Matthews, Saad had told him that his family had moved to the UK in the 1970s after their mechanical engineering business was viewed unfavorably by Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. Reports from neighbors and family friends all unanimously reported that Saad al-Hilli was a kind man and a loving, involved father to his daughters. Saad's neighbor, Jack Saltman, described Saad and Iqbal in an interview as such. "He was a very tactile, loving father. He loved to gather his girls up and cuddle them. They would go running at him and he would catch them in his arms and kiss them. He adored them. His wife was very quiet. She wasn't as gregarious as Saad. But she would always stop for a chat, particularly with my wife. She was a wonderful housewife and mother as far as I could see. My wife had a hip operation, and the first card we got wishing her a good recovery, this was only 5 or 6 weeks ago, was from Saad's wife. They were just nice people. It's just profoundly heartbreaking." Another of Saad's friends, James Matthews, also described him as a very loving father. James and Saad had met through their children, who attended the same playgroup, and they had apparently become pretty close. James said that Saad had helped him fix his car up, and that they had both worked together to build the workshop in Saad's garden. During an interview with reporters, James also dismissed the rumors of conspiracy around Saad and his family's deaths, saying, "I think if there had been something bubbling up like that, a conspiracy, I would have known it." Publicly available information about Saad's line of work is somewhat nebulous. He apparently worked as a freelance computer-aided design engineer, and helped with the designs for the Airbus A380 aeroplane. His accountant, Julian Stedman, said he ran a company called Steck Limited, registered to his home address. Online records show that Hilli was also a director of a Swindon-based company offering business services, aerial photography, and survey services. He also apparently had links with Guildford-based Surrey Satellite Technology. In short, the rumor was that SAD worked around some sensitive topics. That, combined with unconfirmed reports about the family's past links to Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and his political party, led to speculation that the murders were contract killings carried out by members of the fallen Hussein regime. In fact, mere months following the murders, the respected French newspaper Le Monde released a report claiming that Saad had access to a Swiss bank account that actually belonged to Saddam Hussein's political party, known as BOF. This report apparently originated from the German Secret Service and potentially linked Saad with Saddam Hussein's missing fortune. Diving further into the family background, the supposed links to Saddam Hussein came more through Saad's father, Kadim, rather than through Saad himself. Kadim had been a successful businessman in Iraq, both before and after Saddam's party, the Ba'athist, seized power. He initially worked as a lawyer, but eventually branched out into selling building materials, bricks and cement, and further down the line, tissue paper and even poultry. Kadim decided to move his family to the UK in 1971, after his brother was arrested by the Mukhabarat, the Iraqi intelligence agency, and disappeared for a year. When he reappeared, he had clearly been tortured, with permanent brain damage and slurred speech to show for it. One can hardly blame Kadim then for wanting to move his family to a different country after seeing a loved one go through that. After moving to the UK, Kadim returned to Iraq in 1974 to oversee his business, which is a fact that conspiracy theorists pointed to as suspicious. However, Kadim did in fact own a business that was located in Iraq, and dictatorship or no dictatorship, the economy was still chugging along and businesses still needed to be run. Either way, Kadim retired and returned to England in 1982. After hearing this background, you're probably thinking, these supposed links to Saddam Hussein, if you could even call them that, seem to amount to nothing more than the fact that Saad and his father were both of Iraqi origin, and Saddam Hussein is also, of course, Iraqi, and that his father Kadim returned to Iraq for a while after moving to the UK. If you had that thought, then you're exactly right. The links are tenuous, to say the least, and seem to be rooted more in prejudice than in fact. The Swiss bank account that supposedly was linked to Saddam Hussein's political party does in fact exist, but it is very likely nothing more than the bank account of a successful businessman. It's not like there are any links to known war crimes or anything like that. Unsurprisingly, the Saddam Hussein link was quickly denied by French authorities. The head of the murder investigation, Gendarmerie Colonel Benoit Vinman, said quite plainly, "This is false. No intelligence service from any country has given us any information of this kind." Following this report, ANSI prosecutor Eric Maillot expressed frustration at the reporting around this case. Since officially the investigation was meant to be kept under wraps, there was a severe lack of official information being released from investigators to the press. In the absence of official information, however, any and all leaks, some accurate, some false, and some taken out of context, were taken as true and reported as such, allowing theories such as the Saddam Hussein link to be reported as fact without official confirmation. The other main theory based off of the idea that Saad was the main target is much closer to reality, and involves one of the most common motivations for murder: family disputes and inheritance money. At the time of the murders, Saad and his brother Zaid hadn't spoken in about a year, except through lawyers and solicitors helping them sort out their late father Kadim's affairs. Kadim had left behind over $1 million in a Swiss bank account, the one rumored to be linked to Saddam Hussein, along with a house in the town of Claygate just south of London, and an apartment in Spain. Both brothers naturally were in disagreement over who should get what. Zaid, however, claimed that he believed he and Saad were being civil about their disagreement, claiming whatever feud there was being fought via letters and file briefs from their respective lawyers, rather than anything even remotely physical or even verbal. Zaid also found the rumors about his brother being the victim of a hit ridiculous. Not only did he not believe that Saad's work was anything near classified or important enough to justify killing him over, but he also pointed out the logistics behind arranging a hit on someone while they were on vacation in a different country. Wouldn't it have been simpler to just kill them at home, where he presumably had a routine, not to mention a house he went back to at the end of every day? Imagine Zaid's surprise then, when 23 days after the murders, on Friday, September 28th, 2012, the police came to Zaid's door with a warrant to search his apartment. Police had searched the Al-Hilli family home and found something that they described as suspicious: a taser. Now, while tasers might not be out of the ordinary in some countries, in the UK, citizens owning a taser was actually illegal, and in fact, Saad was risking prison time by having it in his house. Although this could have been as simple as a woman still carrying pepper spray in her bag even in places where it's illegal. Police thought that Saad owning this taser meant that he believed his life and his family's lives could have been in danger. Add to that the fact that the taser was capable of jolting someone with 50,000 volts, and that Saad had actually been killed by an unknown assailant. It suggested to investigators that him owning this taser certainly wasn't nothing. Police reported that recordings of a phone conversation between Saad and Zaid pointed towards their relationship being more volatile than Zaid had painted it. They also spoke to other family members who claimed that Saad was frightened of his brother. Zaid thus became a prime suspect for a time. Although nothing was found during that initial search of his apartment, the investigation into Zaid continued. He was questioned on and off continuously over the next 7 to 8 months, with some interviews lasting up to 8 hours. In June of 2013, 9 months after the murders, French authorities presented Zaid with a summons ordering him to appear in France as a witness. Zaid refused, claiming that he did not trust them or their reasoning for summoning him to France. However, later that month, detectives showed up at his door to arrest him for conspiracy to commit murder. The suspected motivation, of course, being that Zaid wanted Saad out of the way so that he could have the entirety of their father's estate. However, like seemingly every other theory in this investigation, the case against Zaid fell apart quite quickly. Zaid was released the next morning on bail, and throughout the next few months of investigation, no evidence for his guilt ever surfaced. Police were forced to lift Zaid's bail conditions in January of 2014, leaving them once again starting from scratch. Zaid, for his part, fully maintained his innocence throughout the entire ordeal, and continues to insist that there was no reason for Saad to be the victim of a targeted killing. Instead, he claimed that the only reason investigators latched onto Saad as the prime intended target was simply due to his race, stating, "I think this was a declaration of war against us. I think they hoped that these Arabs would be terrorists or drug dealers. I think we were manna from heaven for them. On the one hand, they say they don't know what happened. In the next sentence, they say it had nothing to do with a French cyclist. He was just in the wrong place at the wrong time." Well, these two statements contradict each other, you know, at least 50%. What Zaid was suggesting, of course, was that if there had been an intended target, it was the French victim, Sylvain Mollier, not the foreigners on vacation who normally did not spend time in Annecy. Furthermore, he suggests that the reason French investigators brushed Sylvain's potential as the intended target under the rug was to make it seem as though this horrific crime originated outside of France, rather than being a local problem. But is there any reason to believe that Sylvain Mollier could have been the killer's real target? That's after the break. Sylvain Mollier was 45 years old, divorced, and the father of 3 children, 2 with his ex-wife, 1 with his current girlfriend. At the time of his death, he had until recently been employed at a factory in the town of Eugina, not far from Annecy. This factory is owned by a company called Cesis, a subsidiary of Areva, which just so happens to be one of the largest suppliers of nuclear components in the world. The factory in Eugina primarily crafted components for nuclear reactors. And so here we are again, with one of the victims potentially being linked to some sort of sensitive information that could have been the reason behind this murder case. In this case, nuclear secrets. Given that nugget of information, it's not difficult to spiral it out into a tale that ends in Moliere's murder, with the Al-Hilli family in this case being the unfortunate bystanders. However, the tales of Saad Al-Hilli having access to sensitive secrets that led to his death turned out to be mildly exaggerated, to say the least. Is the same true for Sylvain Moliere? In the weeks following his death, Moliere's job at the Eugena factory was described in various terms ranging from senior production manager to some sort of nuclear technician. If this were the case, knowing how many organizations or even nations that are willing to deal in nuclear secrets, it's not that hard to imagine that Moliere perhaps could have gotten involved and gotten in well over his head. Some even speculated that perhaps Saad and Moliere, the supposed nuclear technician and satellite engineer, were in cahoots, and that it wasn't a coincidence that they somehow ended up on the same mountain road together on that day. Perhaps they both got killed because they were, in fact, working together. However, while it's interesting to speculate on the role Moliere's work could have played in his death, as well as potential connections between Sylvain Moliere and Saad Al-Hilli, public prosecutor Eric Maillot sums up this line of thinking quite well in one simple phrase: for a novelist, it's an amazing story. Indeed, when looking further into Moliere's background, any theories regarding this case being related to his work falls apart almost instantly. For one, Sylvain Moliere's actual job at the Eugena factory was as a welder, and he had absolutely zero access to anything resembling nuclear secrets, and it seems unlikely that the relatively small factory in Eugena would hold such secrets anyways. Additionally, there was no evidence of Saad Al-Hilli and Sylvain Moliere ever coming into contact with one another prior to that fateful day on that mountainside road. Still, that doesn't necessarily mean that Sylvain couldn't have been the intended target for some other reason. As Eric Maillot put it, many murders can be linked to one of two motives: sex or money. Is there any evidence to suggest someone had a motive for killing Sylvain due to one of these reasons? Sex, it seems, could be dismissed. Although Sylvain Moliere had a bit of a reputation as a playboy in his younger days, he had been settled with his girlfriend for over 2 years, and there did not seem to be any jealous boyfriends or husbands lurking on the sidelines who would have had a reason to slaughter him and 4 other innocent people. So, what about money? 3 months after the murders, British tabloids reported that Moliere's girlfriend, Claire Schutz, had recently become a paper millionaire after ownership of her father's pharmacy had been transferred over to her. The Schutz family, the papers reported, was growing increasingly irritated by Moliere's mooching off of his girlfriend's money without contributing anything in return. He had recently taken a 3-year leave from his job at the Eugena factory, after all. This theory, however, was also dismissed by Eric Maillot. The British tabloids, it appeared, had gotten some key facts wrong about Claire's millionaire status, namely that she did not actually yet have ownership of her father's pharmacy at the time of his death, but was instead in the process of buying it. What the prolificness of this theory in Britain made clear was that each country, France and Britain, wanted the problem to have originated in the other. Again, from the prosecutor, Eric Maillot, it was not conceivable for many English people, including English journalists, that the problem originated in Britain. I think that the Hundred Years' War is not yet over. And so that's where we're left when looking into the background into the two most likely intended targets in this case, Saad Al-Hilli and Sylvain Moliere. At first glance, there are several potential angles, but looking further into them reveals no evidence at all, just mere speculation and exaggerations that have been spun out into stories that better fit into a crime novel than in real life. Prosecutor Eric Maillot's one real potential suspect besides Zaid was a motorcyclist spotted by some forestry workers on the day of the murders. These workers had apparently gotten a good enough look at him to give information to an artist who created a sketch of the mysterious motorcyclist. This sketch was released to the public in October of 2013, but in March of 2015, even this wildcard suspect was ruled out. The motorcyclist was identified as a businessman from Lyon who had no criminal record nor any connection to the victims. Brett Martin, the man who discovered the bodies, was also briefly considered a suspect, but his story and background were investigated and nothing suspicious came up. So, no suspect, no motive, and 4 people, 3 of whom were tourists, dead on a normally quiet mountain road in a relatively crime-free town. To put it bluntly, what gives? If all of the potential suspects and motivations for killing either Sylvain Moliere or the Al-Hilli family can be eliminated, what are we left with? The answer to that question is the lone psychopath theory, the theory that's become the most popular with investigators in recent years. Lone psychopaths are, to put it frankly, incredibly rare. The vast majority of murders are committed for a reason well beyond random person feels like killing a stranger for no particular reason. Random killings do happen, however, and given the fact that every other lead in this case led to a dead end, this theory has to be considered. One of the biggest pieces of evidence that the lone psychopath theory could be legitimate in this case is quite simply that neither Sylvain Mollier or the Al-Hilly family had any intention of being up on that mountain road that day. Saad Al-Hilly had not rented a car in France. Rather, he had put his family car on the ferry and carted it over to France the week before the murders. Security cameras at the ferry terminal, as well as at gas stations and along the highway that the family had taken down to Annecy, as well as in and around Annecy itself, were scoured for any signs that the family was being followed. But no vehicle or motorcycle ever appeared more than once in the footage alongside the Hillies, indicating that they were indeed not followed. While it's technically possible that someone tailing them managed to remain outside of the field of vision of every CCTV camera along their path, it's incredibly unlikely. On the day of the murders, Saad had asked his daughter Zainab what she wanted to do that day. Go shopping in Annecy or go for a walk in the woods? Zainab chose to go for a walk in the woods. Saad took suggestions from a local man as to where to go, but it seems as though the family got lost somewhere along the way. And once they ended up on the winding mountain road, they had no way to turn around until they had reached a parking area about 3 kilometers up. In other words, there was no indication that the Hilly family was being followed, and they had no particular reason to be on that road at that time on that day. It was pure chance. Similarly, it also seems likely that Sylvain Mollier had gotten a bit turned around during his bike ride that day. His girlfriend's father had suggested a biking route to him, but Eric Maillot says that this route more than likely involved taking an easily missed sharp left at the base of the mountain, perhaps the same turn that the Al-Hilly family had been meant to make, rather than biking straight up it. Either way, Sylvain Mollier also had no plans and no reason to end up on that particular mountain road that day. And if this was a planned killing, regardless of which victim was the intended target, wouldn't the killer have chosen a time and place where they had good reason to believe their target would be? If this is all true, that no one was following either the Hillies or Mollier, that no one had any reason to believe that any of them would be in that particular place at that particular time, then we're left with the answer to this baffling case being that it was the rarest of crimes, the true stuff of nightmares. A completely random slaughter committed for no real reason, by someone who had no motivation besides feeling the urge to kill and who got away with it. The lone psychopath, in other words. While this is again incredibly rare, this type of murder is by far the most difficult to solve. After all, if you leave no traces at the crime scene and have no connection to the victims, how are the police meant to find you? The police in this case certainly did try to pursue this lone psychopath theory. Assuming that the perpetrator must have had some experience with firearms, they cross-referenced military records with psychiatric hospitals, but did not find anyone who fit the bill. However, something interesting happened in April of 2014. While working their way through a list of just about everyone that Sylvain Mollier's girlfriend, Claire Schutz, had ever known, police stumbled upon a man named Patrice Menegaldo, who they called in and interviewed for about an hour as a tangential witness. Just someone who maybe might have known something about Sylvain that police hadn't already found out. Patrice was 50 years old, he lived in Eugene, where the factory Sylvain Mollier previously worked at was located, and he was a former paratrooper in the French Foreign Legion. 2 months later, Patrice shot himself in the head. He left a letter behind, in which he wrote that he couldn't handle being a suspect in a murder. This was curious, because Patrice hadn't, in fact, been a suspect in a murder. He had been little more than a character witness. The detectives had never accused him of being complicit in the murders. He was never in custody, and there was no evidence whatsoever connecting him to the crime. As a former military man who it seems perhaps had some mental issues, he could fit the profile of the lone psychopath that the police were searching for. It was Patrice, in the woods, with the gun, who then committed suicide under the weight of his own guilt and the misplaced belief that the police were onto him. Still, not every piece quite fits. If this was true, why wait until 2 months after the interview to commit suicide, rather than in a panic right afterwards? Patrice Menegaldo also left behind a 7-page suicide note, of which the part where he claimed that he could not handle being a suspect in a murder was only a small part. Investigators haven't released the remaining contents of the note, likely for privacy reasons. It's very tempting to try and pin everything on Patrice Menegaldo, given what is publicly known, but there's still no hard evidence placing him on the road on that day. So to sum it up, there's no reason to believe anyone knew that the Al-Hilly family or Sylvain Mollier would be where they were on that day. No particular reason to believe that anyone would target them, and no other leads in this lone psychopath theory. Where does that leave us? Before we wrap this up, there is, believe it or not, one final angle to consider. In a case that has so many angles to consider that it somehow feels like an infinitely reflective prism. This information was first reported in July of 2014, nearly 2 years after the murders took place. Like all of the other many angles considered in investigating this crime, there's a very high likelihood that it's absolutely nothing at all, just yet another dead end. And yet, even if it is nothing, it's still an interesting coincidence. A mere 7 hours after these four people were murdered in the French Alps, a man who lived in Natchez, Mississippi by the name of James Thompson told a friend that he wasn't feeling well. James was a former cop and oil field worker, and had once been married to a woman by the name of Iqbal. The same Iqbal who later moved to England and married Saad Al-Hilly, and who was murdered in the Alps that day. After Iqbal and James were married in 1999, they split up only a few months later. Iqbal did not tell anyone about her first marriage. Even her brother-in-law Zaid was unaware until this piece of information was first announced by French investigators. It was unusual, especially in the 1990s, for Iraqi women to marry Americans, and would have been controversial on both sides at the time. As prosecutor Eric Maillot put it, people have exploded families for less than that. After James Thompson drove off from work that day, the same day that his ex-wife was mysteriously killed thousands of miles away across the ocean, his truck slowed down and went off the road. James Thompson had died behind the wheel due to a massive coronary. Given his general health, he was overweight, had high blood pressure, and smoked. This news wasn't exactly what one would call shocking. It's the timing that gives some people pause. What are the chances of a secret ex-husband dying of a coronary mere hours after his ex-wife was killed in a still unsolved murder, with no apparent motive and no clear suspect? Is this a coincidence? Most likely. James himself, of course, couldn't have been at the scene of the crime, and no evidence has ever arisen that he hired someone to go after his ex-wife, or that perhaps someone who disapproved of their relationship had decided, years later, to enact revenge. But, like most things in this case, it's a coincidence that raises yet more questions and invites more speculation, but answers absolutely nothing. Nearly an entire decade has passed since this crime took place, and investigators are no closer to locating the perpetrators than they were on September 5th of 2012. The crime itself is a sort of scar, marring the beauty of this picturesque mountain town. Some have taken to calling it the perfect crime, knowing that somehow, someone managed to murder four people in the middle of the day on a public road, and they have gotten off for scot-free for 9 years and counting. Hopefully the victims in this case will receive justice, but until then, the stories of Saad Al-Hilly, Iqbal Al-Hilly, Suhaila Al-Alaf, and Sylvain Mollier will remain unresolved.